by Dr. Stevens and Senator, I think, Gravel at that time.
You said that Sean C. Has distributed 1.5 acres, I think that's under ANILCA, to all of its shareholders. How many shareholders does it have?
We distributed them on the basis of original shares of stock, and we have 317,000 shares, so we have 317 lots. So that would be approximately 460 acres.
Well, shares have been...
Each person that originally owned the 100 shares of stock received 1.5 acres.
Well, what about people who died and left their shares in their will to their children, and those children hold 50 shares each or 25 shares each? Do they altogether get 1.5 acres, or how do you handle that?
We had to leave because of the time involved. It took us 3 years to go from the planning to the distribution, and we determined that at that point it was going to be easiest for us to issue or distribute the land to the original 100 share owners and allow and require that any person that had partial shares or partial ownership of a lot, that that would have to be settled between those people, because if we had attempted to do that, it would have thrown another factor into the determination of fair and equal value, because those were the criteria that we had to work with, was fair or equal value and equal size. And we used the criteria of waterfront. Each person has 145 feet of waterfront, and the acreage is within 10% plus or minus of being equal.
And the shareholders wanted that, and the lots are in the process of being conveyed, are they?
The board of directors at the last meeting passed the resolutions that were necessary to put together the covenants and the deeds. We require that Sean C. have right of first refusal in perpetuity on the lots, and we are going to attempt to purchase all lots that shareholders want to sell, unless those lots are going to be traded or sold between shareholders.
And those lots will be held in fee simple by each shareholder, and will in due course be taxable, I take it.
If they are under the control of a city or borough government, they would be taxable, but at this time all of the land disposals have been outside of city limits.
In the unorganized borough?
Right. And at this point I'm not a director anymore, but the board is considering now whether we should change the status under which we're going to convey the land from ANILCA to conveyance or issuance of fee simple title under the Internal Revenue Code, because of the value and taxation potential if we do it under ANILCA. ANILCA would allow us a value of $40 an acre, and what has been the appraised value now is $13,000, and our attorneys have advised us that if we convey the land under the terms of ANILCA at a value of $60 per lot, our shareholders may be immediately liable for taxation. I think it was capital gains, I'm not sure, on the remaining $12,660, $12,960.40, whatever it is. And that is I think that is holding up the issuance of the deeds right at this point. And I think that our president is meeting with the attorneys to hopefully straighten it out.
You've been talking about IRAs, the proposal has been made in many places that the corporations should transfer their land to the IRAs to ensure that it cannot be taken if the corporation is taken over, and to make sure it can't be taxed by the state, the unorganized borough, or a taxing borough. I assume that's what you were driving at a minute ago.
In some terms, yes, I know, I couldn't tell you exactly how I would see the transfer take place, but I think that the assets of the tribe should come under the auspices of the tribal government.
Well, all right, in Heidelberg, you have an IRA, you could do that, I suppose. Let's assume you could do it. What would you do about the land held by the regional corporation, Sea Alaska? Is that a concern of yours? In other words, I can see your point about the village corporations. There's the corporation, there's the shareholders that live in the village. I mean, a lot of them do anyway. And I assume in Heidelberg, majority do?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I think that most of the shareholders of Heide Corporation live out of Heidelberg. Most of the shareholders of Sean Seat live in Craig. I do know that.
Okay, let's suppose you needed a vote of the shareholders of the Heide Corporation to transfer the land from Heide Corporation to the IRA. How do you think those people living outside Heidelberg would look on that proposal?
I would say that there would be a very difficult question for me to answer, but I think that it could be approached such that okay, tribes have the authority to determine their membership as a function of their sovereign powers. And determination of membership can be done in any way that the tribe desires to do so, and I think that the structuring of it could be done so that those shareholders could still be, for all intents and purposes, shareholders and have the ability to get the rights and profits or benefits of the corporation.
So they would be tribal members?
Yes.
And let me return to what I was asking you about regional corporations. The proposal has been made in many places that the village corporations should transfer their land to the local IRA, but nobody suggested what would happen to the regional corporations. Are you leaving that out of the equation for the moment?
My position would have to be that, as I said before, I think that the regions are overburdened with so many restrictions, and they don't have the ability to provide benefits to shareholders, which is their major purpose. And I would suggest that the assets of Sea Alaska be divided among the village corporations, because they're the entities that have the most ability to provide benefits to shareholders as a business entity. And I think that may sound a little bit radical to the Sea Alaska board, but I don't think that it's just transferring and use of assets doesn't mean that Sea Alaska would disappear. But utilization of the entities that we have, should take place, and we should start looking at what we should do with that land. And I think that using the village, the region should be using the villages to make more money. They could be using us as holding companies or means by which they could make more money than they do under the terms of 7I and 7J and all the hoops they have to go through.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Mr. Abel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's another interesting little thing.
Yeah, I saw that. That's pretty rough stuff. Well, sit down if you like.
Adrian Licorno again. We're talking about the IRAs and the relationship with Tlingit and Haida, and there were some interesting discussions when they were trying to implement the Self-Determination Act. They had some Senate hearings on problems of definition of tribe in Alaska, and I thought that that would be a good source for looking at the issues, because that's one of the questions that has really been prevalent in the communities, is that what is our relationship with Tlingit and Haida, and what is the proper relationship in the sense, are we a confederation, or are we one single government? And I don't think that's ever been clear to the people in the communities. So that's basically all I was going to say.
Thank you.
My name is Woodrow Morrison. I just want to add a few things to what I had to say yesterday, and some of them will try to get to the point. I listened to the question that was posed to Mr. Abel about what would happen to Sea Alaska assets if we Haidas were to form our own tribal government. And in my view, if we were to form our own tribal national government, the jurisdictional boundaries of those lands would include the lands owned and the resources owned by Sea Alaska Corporation and possibly other corporations. There would be no problem with ownership. The primary difference would be that Sea Alaska Corporation or any other village corporations who owned property within the jurisdictional boundaries of the tribal government would then pay taxes to us and not to the United States government. That would put us in a position of being able to put together our own bank and possibly set up a system similar to numbered bank accounts in Switzerland or in other places. They would have to report their income to us, and rather than being a very complex taxation system, the way the present IRS regulations are for the taxing of timber, could possibly be very simple, based on a fixed percentage of whatever is harvested, something to that effect. But other things that I wanted to clarify is in comments about the Indian Reorganization Act, and I'll read from a paper that was written by an eminent legal scholar, namely myself. It has to do with the title of the paper was Haidas, a Tribe Becoming a Nation. And one section in here, page 6 of the paper, deals with the Heidelberg Cooperative Association. And I'll just read directly from it. In 1934, Congress passed the Wheeler-Howard Act, better known as the Indian Reorganization Act. The act did not include Alaska, so on May 1, 1936, Congress amended it. Section 1 of that amendment provided, in quotes, that groups of Indians not heretofore recognized as bands or tribes, but having a common bond of occupation or association or residence within a well-defined neighborhood, community, or rural district, may organize to adopt constitutions and bylaws and to receive charters of incorporations and federal loans under Section 16 and 17. And Section 10 of the Act of June 18, 1934, set forth the kinds of organizations possible under the Act. 1. A group consisting of all native residents of a locality may organize to carry on municipal and public activities as well as enterprises. This type would be suitable for exclusively native villages. Authority for municipal activities is based on the provision of Section 16 of the Act of June 18, 1934, providing that constitutions may contain all powers of an Indian group recognized under existing law. 2. Groups consisting of all native residents of a locality may organize solely for business purposes without contemplating municipal activities. This type of organization is suitable in the case of Indian groups residing in white communities which already provide for municipal activities. 3. A group not comprising all the residents of a locality, but comprising persons having a common bond of occupation or association, may organize to carry on economic activities. In the case of such organization, cooperative and democratic features in the method of organization are encouraged, and as wide a base among natives is sought as is possible in the circumstances of the case. The Heidelberg Cooperative Association was organized under this third instruction. The first instruction was designed to create Indian municipalities and native villages that were exclusively native. And at the time it was set up, Heidelberg is now nearly exclusively native. But the Indian Reorganization Act watered down any concepts of sovereignty, or most of the concepts of sovereignty, by putting them in the different types of structures as appeared in the regulations. And I do have a couple of comments on each of those different instructions. Now, the instruction number one, where it talks about consisting of all native residents of a locality may organize to carry on municipal and public activities, this instruction reduces Native American groups down to mere municipalities without true governmental powers over their own affairs. However, the instruction contains the phrase, in quotes, providing that the Constitution may contain all powers of an Indian group recognized under existing law. Query, does the phrase mean all powers of an Indian group recognized under existing law, or all powers recognized under existing law? In my opinion, although I will not attempt to demonstrate my conclusion, the phrase can be reasonably construed to mean that the IRA constitutions may provide for all those powers necessary for self-government, absent secretarial approval. However, it would appear that this language has been used to dupe tribes into believing that they may assume only those powers permitted by the secretary, and as a result, adopted weak constitutions. Instruction 2 even further diminished tribal sovereignty. That one refers to groups comprising all the native residents of a locality where the predominant group is white. This particular instruction waters down the concept of a sovereignty to be less than a municipality. In essence, this organization is a social organization created to provide social services for Indians, a minority institutionalized as a race and not a specific political entity. If such urban Indian groups are to retain a national identity, they must establish a national allegiance, i.e. seek recognition from a tribal nation that could best represent their national identity. Native American urban organizations are going to have to function as more than, say, the German Club of Albuquerque or the Polish American Club of Milwaukee if they hope to survive as distinct peoples. There must be formal ties between tribal governments and urban Indian groups if they are to achieve legitimacy and enhance their chances of avoiding cultural genocide. And now the third instruction is the one that the Heidelberg Cooperative Association organized under. Arguably, if the Haida so desired, they could amend the Heidelberg Cooperative Association constitution to include municipal activities. But regardless of the possible amendments, the IRA did not contemplate the creation of native national governments, nor does the thinking of tribal councils include perceiving themselves as such. It is no wonder that tribal sovereignty has been so diminished by case law that many tribal councils, in effect, derive their powers from state constitutions or state statutes. So the Indian Reorganization Act, in some instances, is probably the one vehicle that has permitted most tribes to survive. However, it does not plan for the long term. And when we talk long term, we're not talking 5 or 10 years, we're talking 20, 50, maybe 100 generations. And the Native Claims Settlement Act is the same way. I hadn't intended to begin at that point, but there's another point in which most people haven't dealt with the corporations. And again, I'll read from my paper here. The term Indian country defines the geographic area in which tribal and federal laws normally apply and state laws do not apply. 18 U.S.C.A. 1151B states that Indian country means all dependent Indian communities within the borders of the United States, whether within the original or subsequently acquired territory thereof, and whether within or without the limits of the state, unquote. In Donnelly versus the United States, 228 U.S. 243, 1913, the Supreme Court held that land set aside from the public domain by executive order for use as an Indian reservation was Indian country. Not all of the lands presently occupied by the Haidas are the product of the federal reservation policy, however, and thus some Haida lands are technically not reservation lands. The lands of Haida Corporation were not the result of an executive order conveying them to the corporation, but the result of a congressional enactment. The lands conveyed to Haida Corporation are fee simple lands. Do fee simple lands qualify as trust lands? In United States versus Sandoval, 231 U.S. 28, 1913, the court held that the lands of the Pueblo Indians, which were not federally owned reservations but consisted of communally owned lands held in fee simple, were nonetheless Indian country since they were occupied by distinctly Indian communities, which were dependent tribes recognized and protected by the federal government. The simple ownership of lands by federally recognized dependent Indian tribes is sufficient to bring the lands so held within the ambit of the phrase Indian country. In State versus Young Bear, 229 Northwest 2nd, 728 Iowa, the Iowa Supreme Court correctly stated that the appropriate test to determine whether a reservation is within the definition of Indian country set forth in Section 1151 is not how the land was acquired, but whether the land has been set apart for the use and occupancy of Indians. In the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, Section 1612, subsection A1 provides, in quotes, a grant of each native village which qualifies under the requirements and procedures set forth in this act of title to the village site and additional lands adjacent thereto for community use and expansion. This section makes clear Congress' intent to set apart lands for the use and occupancy for the Haidas. A split formally existed in the cases as to the extent to which lands held for Alaska Natives and their descendants are Indian country within the meaning of Section 1151, but the question has temporarily been solved by Congress conferring both civil and criminal jurisdiction over Alaska Natives over to the state of Alaska. Fortunately, the definition of Indian country is quite expansive. Once a reservation has been established or a dependent Indian community shown to exist, it will remain Indian country until terminated by Congress, irrespective of the nature of the land ownership. The question then has the ANSCA created reservations in Alaska, or more specifically, are Heidelberg lands Indian country? In Section 1601G of the Act, it states, Congress finds and declares that no provision of this chapter shall be construed to terminate or otherwise curtail the activities of the Economic Development Administration or other federal agencies conducting loan or loan and grant programs in Alaska. For this purpose only, the terms Indian reservation and trust or restricted Indian-owned land areas shall be interpreted to include lands granted to natives under this chapter as long as such land remains in the ownership of native villages or regional corporations, unquote. There is no doubt that Congress created trust lands or reservations in ANSCA. The next question is whether Haida Corporation is a tribe. In the Joint Tribal Council of Passamaquoddy Tribe versus Morton, 328 F. 2nd, 370 in 1975, the federal government refused the Passamaquoddy tribe recognition because it had never entered into a treaty agreement with the United States government. The court held, but while Congress's power to regulate commerce with Indian tribes, U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, includes authority to decide when and to what extent it shall recognize a particular Indian community as a dependent tribe under its guardianship, and that's from Sandoval. Congress is not prevented from legislating as to tribes generally, and this appears to be what it has done in successive versions of the Non-Intercourse Act. There is nothing in the Act to suggest that tribe is to be read to exclude a bona fide tribe not already recognized. In the United States versus Candelaria, the site on that's quite long, so I'll just add the first one, 271 U.S. 432. The Supreme Court read Indian tribes as used in the Non-Intercourse Act of 1834, which is found at 25 U.S.C.A. Section 177 to mean a body of Indians of the same or similar race united under one leadership or government inhabiting a particular, though sometimes ill-defined, territory. Haida Corporation fits this definition. Also in Passamaquoddy, the court went on to state that the policy of the Act is to protect the Indian tribe's right of occupancy even when the right is not recognized by treaty. Recognition as a tribe does not necessarily equate with trust relationship, so is there a trust relationship between the federal government and Haida Corporation? In Passamaquoddy, the court said, the trust relationship has its source the Non-Intercourse Act. Also, that once Congress has established a trust relationship with an Indian tribe, Congress alone has the right to determine when its guardianship shall cease. Congress included in ANSCA a tax exemption for lands conveyed to native and regional corporations for 20 years. Also, Congress placed restrictions on stock alienation. So it is fairly obvious that Congress intended to create a trust relationship between Haida Corporation and itself. Unfortunately, that trust relationship is due to terminate in 1991. So the question now is, how, in the face of pending termination, do we protect the Haida Corporation assets for future generations? So the point I'm trying to make here is that in taking a look at existing case law, Congress did put into the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act language that for limited purpose, the native corporations and their lands are to be deemed reservations. And in the case of Sandoval, United States versus Sandoval, the court found that the lands owned by the Pueblos was held in fee simple, but the communities were distinctly Indian, and therefore there was a trust relationship between the United States government and the Pueblos who hold their land in fee simple. Now, the fly in the ointment is that the lands of the Haida Corporation or the Haida Tribe of Heidelberg were conveyed by an act of Congress. The lands of the Pueblo Indians were conveyed to the Pueblos by land grant from the Spaniards. So what we have in effect is a illegal fiction, if you will, that the conveyance of lands to the true owners by thieves makes a very great difference depending on who that thief is. If it was given by the Spaniards, then it's all right. But if it's conveyed by the United States, then it's not all right.
Well, who says it's not all right?
I've discussed this with, I can't recall his name now, but it was in May of 1983. The Alaska Federation of Natives called a conference in Anchorage to discuss tribal sovereignty. I voiced my objections to the Alaska Federation of Natives being involved in discussing sovereignty because it was a state corporation. It's been mentioned quite a number of times, the structure of Alaska Federation of Natives. And I don't know if I mentioned it yesterday in my previous testimony, but when I worked for Alaska Federation of Natives in 1972 and 1973, it was sometime in the spring of 1973 that the presidents of the regional corporations met in Anchorage, Alaska, and without any notice to the members of the Alaska Federation of Natives, raided our offices, took all the corporate books or all the company's books, organization's books, held an election, set up a board of directors, incorporated Alaska Federation of Natives, and installed Willie Hensley as its president. And that is how the village people were disenfranchised. But anyway, during that meeting, I asked the solicitor who was present at that meeting.
You mean the solicitor for the Interior? For the
Department of Interior. As to whether or not this case law would apply to the corporations, that a reservation for any purpose is a reservation for all purposes. And his response was that the Pueblos had received their lands from the Spaniards in a land grant in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And so so that is their opinion. And also, when discussing reservations, it was my point of view that the reservation policy of the United States government is one in which, if the United States government takes an, if some act of the federal government is one in which it restricts the activities of a tribe of Indians to a specific locality, they call that a reservation. Those lands, instead of being reserved for us, we are limited to those boundaries. But in the case of the Heidelberg Reservation, the courts saw fit to remove those restrictions, and therefore, from our point of view, a reservation means those lands for which we have reserved for ourselves, that we have never ceded, we've never given up, we've never settled. A settlement normally involves negotiations. The settlement that we talk about, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, is not a settlement because it was a mandate. It was ordered on us. It was never discussed with us. It was not an arm's length bargain. And so the only thing I'm trying to do here is, yesterday I made statements that we're going to have to get rid of the corporations, we're going to have to get rid of the whole system. But what I'm discussing here is, if we are saddled with this thing, here are some of the things that maybe the law provides. I also made
you at a, in a sense, informally, at a meeting held by the AFN last year, no court has decided that the Pueblo's precedent does not apply in Alaska.
No. Also, I've cited the Passamaquoddy case for the reason being that we have no treaty with the United States government. No. However, the Non-Intercourse Act supposedly sets the terms of the guardianship. And if I may, a very famous Canadian, Chief Dan George, made a comment once about the Non-Intercourse Act. He said, since the Non-Intercourse Act was passed, us Indians been intercoursed left and right. But so those are some of my views. I've not really had a chance to express them in other places. But
could you leave that your paper with me? Is that possible?
I'll have to make a copy of it. I do have another one here that deals with something slightly different. It's called The Right Basic to All Societies, The Right to Duplicate Ourselves Recognized. This paper is a survey of Indian policy going back from the very beginning of the first Indian commissioners up to the enactment of the Indian Child Welfare Act. I think I'll just run over this briefly. I don't want to take up any more time than because I know you're running under a tight schedule right now. But anyway, the paper at one point begins with, in 1868, the BIA Commissioner Taylor poses a rhetorical question: shall our Indians be civilized, and how? In answer to his own question, he wrote, assuming that the government has a right and that it is its duty to solve the Indian question definitely and decisively, it becomes necessary that it determine at once the best and speediest method of its solution, and then, armed with right, to act in the interests of both races. Then, following somewhat the same line of reasoning, Commissioner Parker in 1870 said, there is no question of national dignity, be it remembered, involved in the treatment of savages by a civilized power. With wild men as with wild beasts, the question whether, in a given situation, one shall fight, coax, or run is a question merely of what is easiest and safest. The succeeding Commissioner Walker, tightening the screws, in his view in 1872 was, no one certainly will rejoice more heartily than the present commissioner when the Indians of this country cease to be in a position to dictate in any form or degree to the government when in fact the last hostile Indian tribe becomes reduced to the condition of supplicants for charity. Up to this point, the United States government seemed content to merely hold Native Americans as captive and to break their will to resist assimilation. Then a new era began. I'll go on a little bit further here to I'll just read you what my conclusion was in the paper. Over the past four centuries, European immigrants and their descendants have tried everything from physical to cultural genocide to either destroy Native American people or destroy them in a roundabout fashion by assimilation. Yet somehow, a few managed to survive those incredibly intense pressures. A part of it can be explained by the Native Americans' indomitable will to preserve their spiritual convictions. Another part, though very small, can be attributed to occasional humanitarian acts of Congress. The norm is to view legislation as being negative, or at best, actions designed to maintain the status quo. The Indian Child Welfare Act represents the first positive piece of legislation aimed at recognizing the right of the society to not only continue, but also, more importantly, to duplicate itself through the protection of children of the tribal members. Commissioner Francis E. Lupp, in his first report in 1905, illustrated the plight of the Native Americans this way. Suppose a few centuries ago an absolutely alien people, like the Chinese, had invaded our shores and driven the white colonists before them to districts more and more isolated, destroyed the industries on which they'd always subsisted, and crowned all by disarming them and penning them on various tracts of land where they could be fed and clothed and cared for at no cost to themselves. To what condition would the white Americans of today be reduced? In spite of their vigorous ancestry, they would surely have lapsed into barbarism and become pauperized. No race on earth could overcome, with forces evolved from within themselves, the effect of such treatment. That our red brethren have not been wholly ruined by it is the best proof we could ask of the sturdy traits of character inherent in them. And that was from the one commissioner. But he was, Commissioner Lupp, I think, had a dual personality. When he was asked about civilizing Indians, his recommendation was to get to the children, to break the ties with the old, and bring them into this so-called new era. But one of the things about the Claim Settlement Act is that, contrary to my legal training, I'm going to discuss something briefly here that has no place in a court of law, has no place in the halls of Congress, nor in most organized meetings, and that's feelings. We've been told that the United States government is the most humanitarian on the planet. That may be true. I don't know. But I grew up in Heidelberg in an Indian school being taught to be ashamed of what I am. My father and the others won't discuss the things that happened to them, of the beatings, and in some instances of girls just reaching puberty being stripped naked in public for speaking their own language. If you take a look at the psychological effects of those types of actions, any court today would rule it rape. And so trying to grow up with that, and trying to grow up in a society that aspires to Christian ethics, thou shalt not kill unless. To go through the Bureau of Indian Affairs school system was the safest place I've ever spent in my life, at Mount Edgecombe High School. I got up at 7 o'clock in the morning. My day was programmed from then till lights out at 10 o'clock. I finished high school at Mount Edgecombe and went on to school at Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas. Spent 2.5 years there. I was an adult. We were not permitted to travel anywhere in the city except on two streets, 23rd and Main, without special written permission from the school. If I wanted to check out for a weekend, I had to have written permission from my parents in Alaska. If I wanted to ride in a taxi cab or in a privately owned automobile, I had to get written permission. So I had nothing to worry about. Everything was made up for me. And then I joined the United States Navy. I served 4 years, 2 months, active duty, most of it on a heavy cruiser, some of it bringing democracy to Central America, to the Dominican Republic. I was there in 1965 when our humanitarian views were exposed and imposed. And then after I got out of service, I went to Ketchikan, Alaska, and worked for an electronics shop. Most of my friends were members of the Elks Club. They talked me into applying for membership. My sponsors were rather well-known, eminent members of the community, Dr. Carr. In fact, he was the doctor that delivered me when I was born. A man named Paul Hansen, another guy named Harry Ludwigson. One day I was sitting in the shop, and Dr. Carr came in the shop, and he handed me some papers, but he wouldn't look me in the face. There was a letter attached from the investigating committee of the Elks Club that said, "We are returning your membership fee, your initiation fee, and your application. We cannot consider you for membership in the Elks Club because you are not predominantly Caucasian." I thought that I'd earned my right as an American by serving the time that I did in the United States military, only to find that because I'm Haida, I couldn't go into the social club. I couldn't go in and sit at the bar with the rest of the guys. I couldn't go and buy a dinner. And then my girlfriend at the time, his parents belonged to the Improved Order of Red Men right across the street from the Elks Club. I was not permitted to even go in as a guest. And these are the people that demand their right to our land. They demand a right to come into my community and sit on the council. They demand their right to come and get land in my community. They're the people who came and took 30% of our population in World War I, World War II. We had the highest percentage of any community in the United States of men in the military, of any community, 30% of our population. My grandfather, I was but a small boy when he died. 1946, I was 5 years old. He came home from Seattle, Washington. He was sick. He called my mother in to talk to her. There was something that he wanted me to know. He had been to hearings in Washington where we were arguing to try to protect what little we had. And my grandfather told my mother that he knew he was going to die, but he didn't want to die because he said, "We're fighting against forces that we can't even see. We don't know how to deal with those people. No matter which way we turned, we're lined up against batteries of lawyers. We don't even speak English very much, but yet they expect us to know all constitutional law. They expect us to know everything. I want my grandson to be a lawyer." In fact, even before that, I was 4 years old when he took me to the elders and said, "I want this, my grandson, Kauta Anas. He's going to be a lawyer. I want you to teach him." Here I am, 42 years old, with a Native Land Claim Settlement Act sitting in front of me, and having to fight against my own people, going into courts of law to sue and be sued because it's business, watching my grandmother, who's going to be 101 years old, unable to get a nickel out of the corporation because the laws do not permit the corporation to make any distinctions. My son, born a year too late to be Haida. land that my ancestors walked for at least 10,000 years, being stripped of resources to pay off bankers and lawyers, the fish being depleted, the thing that kept us alive since our creation, the land that we know being divided up and being regulated, nobody asking us what we think. People come into our country, set up a state in 1959, I was a little bit too young to vote, are now telling us what the rules are going to be. They're telling us how we're going to live. And if we don't agree with them, it's tough. There are 563 shareholders in the Haida Corporation. They expect us all to be constitutional lawyers. They expect us to be accountants. They expect us to be every damn thing. And yet, if you take that same segment from the white population, where you have an average education of possibly the fifth grade, with an incidence of alcohol abuse of 60%, and you put in those factors with any white population and find out how many of them know what the law is, we're faced with the same thing that most people in the cities are faced with. You never know when a crook or a thief is going to strike. You've got to put locks on the doors. You don't know when you're going to be able to, whether a cop is going to come when you call. Here we are sitting here with what little we have left, having to guard our doors at every turn, not knowing when somebody's going to sue us or whether somebody's just going to come and squat and take what we have. I'm angry. I have a rage that burns in me so bad that I wish to hell they would nuke us now and get it over with. It's like a cancer that keeps eating at us. And yet they're going to laugh at me because I dare to have feelings. White people have taken care of that situation in their own societies by referring to people with feelings as being eccentric artists and put them over in a little corner someplace and hang their work on walls and make criticisms of them. And that's the difference between us and white people, is we feel things. When we walk on this earth, we know that for 1,000 generations, our people have walked the same land. And yet they come up here and walk in 2 years and dare to tell us what's best for it. So why not get it over with? I was watching a commercial on TV, a guy in Vietnam. Said every time I went out on patrol, I wish I'd get shot and get it over with. So why are they toying with us? Why don't you just get it over with, either that or be the type of people that they talk about being? I hate Christians, not because of they're white, most of them, but because they take away our rights. They've destroyed our ways. They've destroyed our belief in ourselves. They've destroyed our relationship with our land. They've destroyed everything just so that they can get some more money in their coffers. They've taken Jesus Christ's exhortation to go out and minister unto the world as a license to commit atrocities. I listened to Reagan talking about Central America. All they're trying to do is make the land available for American industry. The tie between Heidelberg and Craig and Tlahuac Road, it wasn't necessary. The only reason we put that link in there, and I was one of the people who did it, was so that we could get timber hauled to our sort yard in Heidelberg. Purely economic. But we've opened a door for the cockroaches. And I refer to people who come in and squat, and once they're there, you can't get rid of them. They just multiply. There's no place else for us to go. White people can go out into outer space. They can go to other planets if they want. That's the way they think. Use up what's here now, and we'll go to another planet and get resources there. They're homeless. They don't care. They can't feel anything. They can't see anything. And yet we're stupid because we care. And I'm a damn fool for having tears in my eyes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Thank you very much. Well, maybe we'll take a 5-minute coffee break, and then after that we'll hear from others. Would that be all? Well, we'll call our meeting to order again, ladies and gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Judge. For the record, my name is John Scan. During public testimony last night, after my prepared presentation, a slight control disagreement arose from various participants at these hearings of yours. I stand by my statements of last night on what the Land Claims Act has done to us here in Tlaloc. Today I would like to offer possible solutions I see that may help the village corporations on the local levels in the future. I hope that they may be helpful after all I understand from your statewide travels about all you've been getting is a lot of controversy. Number one, as I see us here in Tlaloc, I believe that there should be more involvement by the shareholders in various activities of the corporation. For example, subsidiaries of Tlaloc Hinia. In the past, the board of directors elected themselves directors of subsidiary corporations and affiliate companies. I feel that position should be shared by the members of the board and non-members of the board on as equal a basis as possible. For example, also the 5-member subsidiary fishery board of Tlaloc Hinia Corporation. It should have been 2 from the present board and 3 from the shareholder role. And what is coming at Tlaloc Hinia Corporation now that they're in the final preparations of forming a nonprofit heritage foundation, I recommended to the board that the 5-member board of trustees be appointed to manage this foundation, 1 from the parent corporation, 3 from the shareholder's role, and 1 non-shareholder. I received not much support on it. My point being is that the village corporation must share activities with non-board members on a larger scale. This would eliminate mistrust and hard feelings, as it is now the shareholders are only considered just prior to proxy solicitation every annual meeting. In regards to our elderly, some special amendment needs to be entered within the Land Claims Act so that we may help them more. As it is now, any financial aid affects their pensions and other retirement benefits that they receive. After all, we wouldn't be here as a corporation if it wasn't for them. We also need to ensure more jobs be guaranteed to shareholders and non-shareholders who choose to reside in the immediate area on a year-round basis and not have companies who do work for our corporation bring in imported help from the lower states. In summary, Judge, the corporations should give more attention to employment of shareholders with the opportunity for advancement toward ultimate management of their own corporation and allocate monies for local training programs for all interested and not on a favoritism basis as in the past. Number 2, the corporation should help shareholders with legal, financial and moral support for those with the desire to start their own businesses. One example is that the several shareholders in the past requested financial help and were rejected without any consideration. If I may use myself as an example, I am the owner of Skanalaska Seafoods, a small freezing cold storage here in Klawak. Last year, I leased the Klawak cannery from my parent corporation, my own company. And I employed 39 people in my company last year, of which 34 were shareholders of the corporation, of which I had no obligation to hire. The parent corporation and its affiliates and subsidiaries hired one shareholder. And why I say that they need to help the shareholders enter into business is, one, the biggest problem that we have is political jealousy among ourselves here. And as the result, my parent corporation filed a lawsuit against my corporation, my seafood company, for just political reasons. And as I stated before, that I employed 34 of these shareholders when the parent employed one. That has costed my poor little seafood company approximately $31,000 since last September, fighting my own corporation. I think Kalakina should revert itself and help shareholders who go into business. We also need to eliminate the with political views, opinions, and differences should not be a major factor in corporate decisions where business is supposed to be taken care of. And I strongly believe in this last night's testimony that brought up a few objections here on the 1991 issue. And just for the record today, and for those people who are here today that weren't here last night, I did state, Judge, that I believe that the 1991 issue is one of the biggest frauds ever brought upon our Native people. Today I offer what I hope may be a major factor in resolving this 1991 issue, that I would like to, I think that the corporations should form, that a special task force should be formed with representatives from local Native organizations, specifically in the Klawak instance, the Alaska Native Brotherhood, Alaska Native Sisterhood, the local Clinton Haida chapter, the IRA Council, and Klawakina Corporation. This special task force to start work on solutions and alternatives to the 1991 issue in regards to sale of stock, land status, taxation, and other unseen concerns. The only way corporations are going to survive is if we help each other, listen to each other's ideas, problems, and when decisions are made by a majority, everyone should support the decision unless someone sees something wrong with the business decision other than political reasons. If all else fails in the next few years, I think that our physical assets of the corporation, timber, equipment, etc., should be sold and the monies divided up according to the shares owned, and all the land owned be distributed to the shareholders likewise, to let the shareholders do whatever they want with it, and dissolve the village corporations entirely if our problems are not resolved in the near future here. As I said last night in testimony, our future looks very bleak here in Klawak here. And again, these views are my own personal and not those of Klawakina Corporation, of which I am a board director, or of the regional corporation Sea Alaska, which I am a shareholder. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scan. Thank you very much.
Where's the photographer?
Well, there she is.
Hello. My name is Dewey Scan, Jr. I'm a shareholder of Kloakhinya and Regional Corporation of Sea Alaska. And a lot of this is just off the top of my head in the last few minutes, but some of my primary concerns are for our land and the ecological damage being done by the logging procedures being practiced today. It seems that if we proceed at the present pace and procedures, that nothing will grow because of all the slash left on the ground. If we continue such practices, our land may one day soon look like the land between Kluak Lake and Hollis. And I am puzzled by Sea Alaska's involvement in the area and don't fully understand why they were organized. It is my personal opinion that we could better use the 23,000 acres on the local level, or better yet, leave it be, as most of these 46,000 acres were traditional fishing and hunting grounds. At the present rate of logging, it seems our land was more valuable as subsistence lands because we never went hungry living off the land from time immemorial. And I believe that children born after 1971 be enrolled in our native corporations, although our stock may depreciate in monetary value because of the enrollment, we will gain because there is strength in numbers. Therein concludes my report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Scan.
Do you have any questions?
No, I think I'm satisfied. You take a good picture and